E a ka a ha holoholo ki eki e hanohano ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is reconvened. E noho ilalo, please be seated.
Case number SCWC-17-807. HSBC Bank USA National Association v. Mark Antonio. Arguing for petitioner, Mr. Gary Victor Dubin of Dubin Law Offices. Arguing for respondent, Mr. David B. Rosen of Aldridge Pite, LLP. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Mr. Dubin. Mr. Rosen, are you both ready to proceed today? Mr. Rosen, all right. Mr. Dubin, I will give you a warning of 5 minutes ago, so you can reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Mr. Rosen will give you a warning of 10 minutes ago. Mr. Dubin, here.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm Gary Dubin, appearing on behalf of the petitioners. I want to thank the court for this opportunity to argue this very important case on behalf of thousands of Hawaii homeowners affected by the result that you will announce in this case. The facts are not in dispute.
There's thousands of clients who have their attorneys abandon them?
There are some, but it's the second issue regarding the argument finality versus validity. And the ICA's blanket rule that you can't raise any issue if you lost summary judgment in foreclosure and if you did not appeal. And there are thousands of Hawaii homeowners affected by that. There's many reasons for that. First of all, we have an archaic pleading system where the summons is at the back of what often is a very lengthy complaint. And some homeowners they're frightened by the complaint as it is. They don't see the summons on the back. In California, for example, for a long time, the summons has to be in the very front.
What does that have to do with summary judgment and not appealing to summary judgment? Isn't that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well,
okay.
They had an attorney. They paid the attorney several thousand dollars. They thought he was handling the case. They did not appear. They did get the papers served on them for summary judgment. They called up the loan servicer, and loan servicer said, no, you're not in foreclosure. So they were totally in the dark. But I was trying to explain that the average homeowner is mystified by this system. The average homeowner doesn't understand what the foreclosure complaint is. Often they don't see the summons.
But in this case, I thought the argument was that they saw the summons and they hired an attorney who didn't follow through.
Well.
So I'm a little confused as to why this summons argument is being made in this case.
I don't recall whether they saw the summons or not, but I was just explaining why I was asked the question about thousands of homeowners being affected. And I just wanted to point out that as far as the second issue in the case is concerned, many of them just do not understand what's going on. They can't find an attorney. There's very few attorneys who experience in this area. So there are thousands of Hawaii homeowners over a period of several years. They come to my office after they lost summary judgment and they did not appeal. In this case, it's rather clear because they had an attorney.
Let's focus on that issue. Once they realized summary judgment had been entered, there was still a substantial delay between them realizing that, presumably through receiving notice of the court's action and then taking action to set it aside. Were their actions diligent enough in those circumstances?
This is another problem we have in this field because many times they're ill-advised. They run to the bankruptcy court thinking the bankruptcy court's going to give them a remedy, which generally it does not, cannot. So they were delayed by the various bankruptcy filings. When they came to us, we filed a Rule 60B motion. And as the court knows, you can't, federal law is you can't hold it against somebody when they file the bankruptcy, for bankruptcy protection. And that was why there was a delay.
While you're on the timing of this, Mr. Dubin, could I ask you if it's your understanding from the record that it wasn't until June of 2015 that your clients contacted Mr. Reagan? In other words, it wasn't until then that they contacted him to ask what was going on?
I don't think he ever appeared in the case.
Yes, but I mean, they found that out, I think, in June of 2015 when they got hold of him.
They called him up. And, you know, this is uncontested, their declaration that he said there's nothing he could do for them.
And then there's a delay until you filed the motion with April of 16. So the question is, was that delay reasonable under the circumstances? And your answer to why the delay was because of the bankruptcy?
It was because of the bankruptcy filings.
And in order to set aside a default, there's some requirements that are met, including under the BVM case, I believe, the ability to show a meritorious defense. What would the meritorious defense be?
Well, if you look at the motion for summary judgment, it violates Reyes Toledo 1, violates Matos.
How does it violate Reyes Toledo?
It violates it. I think we pointed it out in the application for writ of certiorari, there was no evidence that the foreclosing plaintiff had the note at the time.
They attached it to the complaint. They attached the note to the complaint.
Well, that's not a verification that they had it. And in the Berend case, this court got it correctly. And the ICA has continued to enforce that aspect of it.
Wasn't the note endorsed to plaintiff?
It was endorsed.
They attached a note endorsed to the plaintiff to the complaint. The affidavit did not state that we had the note at the time the complaint was filed. But if you had raised that argument timely at that time, they could have immediately refiled a new affidavit saying that they did have the note at the time they filed the complaint. So therefore, other than that, what is the meritorious defense that you are asserting?
Well, they didn't do that. They could have an opposition motion for summary judgment, but
they could have come back right away with a reply saying, hey, you know, okay, here's a new declaration. Or they could have refiled an MSJ at that point saying, yep, as we attached to the complaint, we had the note endorsed to us at the time we filed the complaint. I don't understand your Reyes-Toledo standing argument.
Well, that was a challenge, but they didn't do that before Judge Cardozo. And Judge Cardozo ruled that there's a blanket rule because of the Weiss case, because of the ICA several summary disposition orders, that it doesn't matter. He couldn't even consider the issue.
Well, he did refer to the SDM versus Sageco, BDMs versus Sageco three factors, I believe. And so that in terms of, I'm trying to figure out what the meritorious defense was that you could have raised here. Because I'm not convinced that there's a standing issue here. So was there some other, and I think that was really the only thing you raised. So I'm wondering, is there some other meritorious defense that you might have been able to raise to this foreclosure?
Well, we did raise it.
Which was what? Standing?
The standing issue.
Okay. So that's what you're hanging your hat on, standing, meritorious defense standing.
That's it, because this court has held that the standing issue is a part of the plaintiff's case. And it's jurisdictional.
It's not. This court has never held its jurisdiction. We've made it very clear that standing is not a jurisdictional issue. If you take a look at our recent opinion in Tax Foundation, and there are other cases also so holding.
I think it's in your Berend case, but if you allow me, I'll submit it afterwards.
No, standing is not a jurisdictional issue. It's a prudential issue. And it's not jurisdictional. This court clearly had subject matter jurisdiction.
Mr. Dubin, in other cases where the affidavits didn't express that the mortgagee was in possession of the note wasn't attached to the complaint. So there wasn't, there was a question as to whether or not the mortgagee actually, or the note holder, was actually in possession of the note at the time the complaint was filed. But mm-hmm. here, that isn't a question, in as much as they did attach it to the complaint, right?
Well, there are lots of those issues, but the Intermediate Court of Appeals and the string of SDO decisions they've had, they said it doesn't matter. You can't look at it because they have a blanket rule. If you do, in foreclosure, if you lose summary judgment, you don't appeal, it doesn't matter. Even if you can show fraud, lack of subject matter jurisdiction, anything you want. According to those decisions interpreting the Weiss case of this court, it doesn't matter.
What doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter whether there's fraud, lack of jurisdiction, anything.
Including under a Rule 60 motion?
Including under a Rule 60B motion or any other motion. And that's why we're here, because that simply is not the law anywhere. And the first case was Penoyer versus Neff in the U.S. Supreme Court in 1878. And Justice Field held in that case that if something is void, it's void. And you can't later bring it back to life. Then we had the Hazeltine Atlas versus Hartford case, where Justice Black said that latches wouldn't even save the issue because it's a wrong against the institutions of justice. So, and then of course we had the string of cases from this court in Kawamoto, the DuPont cases, Southwest Slope, that are mentioned in my application for writ of certiorari, where the court said false judgments cannot stand over finality. This is the controversy between finality and validity.
And I don't see that. I see saying in this case that Rule 60B based on fraud could not be entertained. I don't see the ICA saying that in this case. This was not the assertion was not fraud. The assertion was standing.
Well, if you submit documents in court that are not accurate, you attest to them being accurate. We didn't have the opportunity to show the fraud.
There was. I'm sorry, but did you argue fraud here now? I didn't see any fraud allegations in your application. I mean, this seems to be a new argument.
In the securitized trust cases.
Is this a securitized trust case? I thought this was a direct mortgage assigned the note and the mortgage. I didn't see MERS on this case. I thought the mortgage was assigned to HSBC.
This is HSBC as securitized trustee.
I see. Okay.
Benefit of certificate holders of Nomura Home Equity so and so asset backed certificate series 2006 FMT. This is a securitized trust case. In a securitized trust case, this is where this whole matter of fraud started. They slice up all these.
I'm sorry, was this an argument on your cert app? I think I'm missing something because I don't recall seeing arguments regarding fraud and securitized trusts in your cert app here. I'm sorry, because if you did, please point it out to me. I may have missed it.
You know, I have many of these cases. I gave you the recent Bonestraw decision of the ICA. In that case, there were two notices of default. They were made by someone who didn't have the loan at the time. They contradicted each other. There are different degrees of fraud, and the ICA wouldn't look at that. You can't bring a case to the attention of the ICA where There was summary judgment and no appeal, and it doesn't matter what it was.
That's not what the ICA said. The ICA was just responding to the issues that were raised on appeal. There was no argument regarding fraud. I just took another look at the cert app. There's nothing about fraud and securitized trust. Basically, you were arguing standing and abandonment. And so that's what the ICA addressed and said that, you know, those arguments were without merit.
I can show the court that in the briefs for the ICA, we argued fraud because they claimed that they owned the they claimed that they owned it. We were contending that they didn't own it as inception or any at any time. And yet they claimed they did.
Mr. Dubin, they had the note and mortgage attached to the complaint in this case. Well, we need to deal with this case.
Well, in that regard, Mr. Dubin, what is the relief that you're anticipating? I mean, if this goes back for a reversal of the motion for summary judgment, wouldn't it appear to you that it offers an opportunity to prove that the note was part of the mortgagee transaction?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a lot of issues in this case. For example, the question of supervening authority, whether Reyes Toledo 1 is retroactive, and the Intermediate Court of Appeals in the recent decision in the John Kim case from the Third Circuit 2 weeks ago, they rejected the argument that it was not retroactive.
So Mr. Dubin, if we do not adopt your Reyes-Toledo argument here, what is your other argument? Abandonment?
The other argument, yes, that's an obvious argument, abandonment. It ties together, though, with the major argument, because it's because of abandonment that they didn't oppose summary judgment and they didn't appeal.
Okay, and so then it goes back to my original question. What would the arguments have been? What would have been the meritorious defenses you could have raised to in opposition to the motion if that an attorney could have raised in opposition to the motion for summary judgment? And if we don't buy the standing argument, I'm not sure anything else was actually argued.
It was also abandonment.
But if to set aside a default, you have to show that there was some impact, right? I mean, you have to show that the, you know, someone, whether if that client had not been abandoned, the client would have been able to raise some sort of meritorious defense.
There's no question about that, because we showed that the declaration supporting summary judgment violated Matos. We showed that there was no evidence that they had the note at inception. So we relied upon Reyes Toledo 1, we relied upon Matos. And that was our argument.
Okay.
Following up on Justice Wilson's question, what effective relief can the court grant now? What's your response to the suggestion that the matter is moot because of the sale to a third party?
I tried to cover that in the memorandum in opposition to that motion to dismiss on mootness. The cases on finality versus validity that argue that validity is more important than finality suggest that if there is a reversal, the issues then become weighing of the equities among the parties. If you have a third-party buyer, did they have notice? Should they have notice? Was the price they paid fair? Are they using the property that they purchased as their home, or is it just a rental property? Do they have thousands of rental properties? These are issues regarding the equities between the original owner and the third party.
Well, my understanding is that the deed was recorded, recorded at the land court. Is that sufficient to cut off challenges to the title of the third party, or is it is there a need to be a transfer certificate of title issue?
I would say in the first instance, that's something to be resolved by the lower court. That issue was not brought up. I saw it in the papers. But basically, it's not a question of the race to get a new certificate title. But it certainly is not set up so the land court becomes a vehicle for preventing the equitable issues to arise. And regarding the issue of mootness, this court has recognized many exceptions to mootness. For example, if this court does not address this issue, it may not come up for a long time. These cases typically are pro bono cases, and it takes a long time. Meanwhile, the injustice, in our opinion, is ongoing.
And I think you also correctly pointed out in your memorandum in opposition to the motion to dismiss based on mootness that you always have a claim for damages, whether or not you could get an equitable remedy of rescission of, you know, whether or not you could get the property back. You always have a claim for damages for wrongful foreclosure. I think that's one of the arguments you made.
Well, we always have the issue of damages, and that's another reason to reverse, because that's an issue of whether you get damages. There may be issues in the case where I've seen cases where it's obvious because of how the Intermediate Court of Appeals has ruled in other cases like the Lathrop case. The securitized trusts take over the property, they'll flip it just so they can create a false sale. In Lathrop, for example, one of my cases, the opposition sold it to their lawyer and then asked for judicial notice of the ICA, and the ICA threw the case out, and then they flipped it to the guy who became the owner of a Hawaiian telephone a month later. So you've got that aspect of fraud.
Your view is the case is not moot.
Yeah, that's another issue that never came up before Judge Cardoza because of this blanket rule of the ICA that misinterprets the Weiss case.
Anything further at this time that you'd like to address from the court?
Yes. We've had a number of cases after these, after the Weiss case, which was, of course, raised. Toledo came after the Weiss case. Pontos came after the Weiss case. And in Ivanova versus New Century, 2016, the California Supreme Court pointed out that strangers are not allowed to just come by and sue you. They've got to prove that they've got the mortgage. And I think, very importantly, this court in the Arakaka case, 110 Hawaii 1, 2006, pointed out that the trial judge has an obligation to independently look at the record to make sure that summary judgment is satisfied on the merits. And in that case, this court ruled that even if there's no opposition to summary judgment, and we feel that had the court fulfilled, lower court fulfilled its Arakaka responsibilities, it would have seemed that all the problems that existed on the merits in the summary judgment.
All the problems. That's a broad statement, Mr. Dubin. Are you essentially referring to the failure to present the note properly?
Yes. We, in our opposite, in our Rule 60B motion, we pointed out the hearsay upon hearsay that didn't even prove the default notice was sent, didn't even prove the general ledger, didn't prove they had the note. Now, what's interesting...
So just, did you point that out to the judge?
I'm just checking to see how much time I have.
Mr. Dubin, did you...
Thank you. Mr. Dubin, a minute left of my 25 minutes. Let me point out that there's been a miraculous...
Mr. Dubin, did you point that out to the judge? Judge Cardozo? That he shouldn't have granted summary judgment even though there wasn't opposition?
Yes, that's in my papers. I point out the Arakaki case, which I thought was an excellent decision.
Do you want anything further at this time, or do you want to reserve your time for
Well, I want to reserve time, but I want to point out an interesting development that's happened. This res judicata idea came from England. Recently, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom in Takhar versus Gracefield Development, and it's hard to get this case, but I have copies of it. The court would like to see it. The Supreme Court of the United Kingdom held that res judicata is not a bar to attacking a final judgment, and rejected all the arguments which in the American cases supports res judicata over validity. And the court may find that case interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. I will hear from Mr. Rosen.
May it please the court, thank you, Your Honors, for giving us the opportunity to argue here today. My name is David Rosen. My client, HSBC Bank, as trustee, was the plaintiff in the underlying case and is the appellee respondent here today. I want to address preliminarily two issues that Justices Pollack and Justices Wilson have raised that I think are very material to the effect of the decision in this case. And Mr. Dubin alluded to this. Justice Pollack questioned Mr. Dubin as to how many cases this type of decision affects. And Mr. Dubin correctly responded that it affects thousands of cases. And it affects thousands of cases for the reason that Mr. Dubin responded to Justice Wilson on, which is, what is the relief here? And what we do in judicial foreclosures is we sell property. And the intent is that you try and maximize the value at an auction for the benefit of all the parties involved. And when this court issued its Mers v. Wise decision 6 years ago, Mr. Dubin and I actually argued that decision in front of most of this court. What the court did in Mers v. Wise is it established a bright line, which said, if you haven't raised an issue as to standing or anything else almost, by the time the foreclosure judgment becomes final, in other words, 30 days after the interlocutory decree order is entered, if there is no appeal, it's final.
And that includes if the attorney you hire and retain fails to do anything? Is that the position of the bank?
Your Honor, I think that we have to deal with that on the facts, and I will deal with it specifically in this case. But yes, it does need to be final. And it needs.
So, what was your answer to the question regarding final? Assuming, and I'm realizing you may have other arguments,
right,
factually, but is your position the number wise that if someone retains an attorney and understands they're being represented by that attorney, and in fact, the attorney has done nothing on their behalf, that there's no relief?
Well, there is relief. There's Rule 55 and Rule 60. And those rules require timely coming to the court and seeking relief. If there's been a fraud on the court, the same would apply. So you have to timely assert your rights. But the reason why we need that finality and why it has to happen before the property goes to sale is because if there isn't finality and there's an auction and there's a confirmation hearing, nobody is going to buy a property out of foreclosure unless you have some assurance that you're actually going to be able to get marketable title. If there's always the possibility, and in this case, we have such a situation, if there's always the possibility that the sale can be challenged at confirmation or even after confirmation or during an appeal, then nobody is ever going to buy a property out of foreclosure. The properties will always revert back to the foreclosing mortgagee because there simply will be no buyers. In this situation, we had the defendants come in and they admit, they don't dispute that they received notice and service of the complaint. The only one of the petitioners who has submitted a declaration is Mr. Mark Antonio. And he's the one who submitted the declaration that's the basis of the ineffective assistance of counsel argument. But he is not the borrower on this note. His wife is the borrower, and she hasn't submitted anything in this case. And just to get it out of the way, because you know we have to look at the practicalities here. There was a very important decision that came out in 2008 from the Intermediate Court of Appeals. It's IndyMac Bank v. Miguel. It was reported at 117 Hawaii 506, 184 P. 3rd, 821. And at page 514 and 829 of that decision, the ICA quoted from a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1989. That case was Newman v. Green. And in that decision, the U.S. Supreme Court, quoting from Judge Posner, said, and I quote, "Law is an instrument of governance rather than a hymn to intellectual beauty. Some consideration must be given to practicalities," end quote. I've viewed the original note in this case. I've viewed the special endorsement that is contained on the back page signed by Gwen Marcantonio. This is an unredacted copy. But what was attached to the complaint, as the court has noted, was a copy of the note with the special endorsement to the plaintiff. There was an attorney affirmation submitted with the motion for summary judgment that also authenticated that the documents attached to the complaint were essentially reviewed and true and correct. And in a decision by the Intermediate Court of Appeals somewhat recently, that decision is in the Mather case. That was an unreported decision issued on May 17th, 2017, in appeal case 15-707. The ICA addressed a situation very similar. There was a specially endorsed note attached to the complaint. There was an attorney affirmation, and there was a declaration by the servicer indicating that plaintiff was in possession of the note.
Was there an issue of attorney abandonment in that case?
There was not.
Okay, so would you please address that issue?
Yes, sure.
Why is that not distinguishing factor in this case?
There is no evidence of attorney abandonment in this case. That's the argument that's been made. But there's no evidence of that. The evidence submitted and what Judge Cardoza actually discussed in his decision denying Mr. Dubin's motion is the fact that a declaration was submitted by Mr. Mark Antonio. Again, he is not the borrower on this note. He was simply an owner of the property.
But he said we, his declaration said we paid, correct?
Yep, yes, Your Honor. But
it's not enough to establish something on behalf of the other folks.
No, because you can't testify as to what someone else may have believed or did.
That you were present when you and your close, your loved one, family member paid an attorney for something? The other person who's there can establish the fact that that transaction took place?
Of course you can, but that's not what it says. Well, let's go through. So the declaration from Mr. Mark Antonio.
Are you now arguing that he doesn't have standing? I'm very confused about this argument. He's an owner of the property. He's on the mortgage. He's lost an interest in the property. So can we – I'm not quite sure where you're going on this.
I'm only addressing the ineffective assistance issue, if that's what the court would –
On what grounds?
So again – And there's two defects with it. Number one, the declaration doesn't establish that Mr. Reagan was retained. And I'll go through that in just a second.
Okay, let's assume, you know what, let's assume he was retained. Let's assume he didn't do what he was supposed to do.
Right.
Right? So then I think the issue is if an attorney doesn't raise, let's assume that he did file a memorandum in opposition, but he didn't raise arguments that he should have raised. Basically, you know, ineffective assistance, I'm not quite sure why we're using that terminology, because I think really it's a, that's more of a criminal concept. But here we're saying that an attorney basically didn't perform his duties, right?
Right.
And he didn't do what he was supposed to do. File a memorandum in opposition or whatever. So I'm still stuck on the fact of the issue of what would he have raised?
What would that attorney, what could he have raised?
Right. So does the, if an attorney doesn't file a memorandum in opposition to a motion, does that mean that a final judgment then gets set aside, even if there's no showing that the attorney failed to raise something that had validity?
So I think we need to go through a couple of steps, and I'm happy to do that. The first, though, is there any evidence that Mr. Reagan was retained to represent the appellants in the underlying case? And there is none.
Well, Mr. Rosen, these are lay people, and I assume you're saying just because they have a receipt signed by somebody who works for Mr. Reagan, acknowledging receipt in cash of $4,900, there's no accompanying contract, legal contract. Is that your argument? But I assume, is that your argument?
It's not really.
Oh, it isn't. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The argument is they were lay people, but they were sophisticated enough to file, at least Mr. Mark Antonio was sophisticated enough to file multiple bankruptcy petitions to delay this proceeding 4 years. They received notice over a dozen times during this case, certificates of service, the MSJ was served on them, the judgment from the interlocutory.
How does this relate to your point as to whether or not Reagan had been retained for purposes of this foreclosure?
So I'm jumping around, but as far as whether or not they should have known that Mr. Reagan was not doing what they believed he should.
That's a different statement now.
Okay.
I thought you were arguing that there was no attorney-client relationship. Now you're saying they should have known that he wasn't doing his job.
Yeah, let me deal with that issue then exactly. Okay. So what the declaration, and again, at the time that this declaration was signed, the Mark Antonios were represented by Mr. Dubin. I'm sure that Mr. Dubin's office assisted in the preparation of this declaration. It's filed with his motion. But even in this declaration, it never says that we paid Mr. Reagan to represent us in this case. It describes a down payment on a retainer, so there clearly was not a full retainer paid. It doesn't...
Doesn't the language say, on August 14th, we paid the law offices of Stuart Reagan $4,900 as a down payment for Mr. Reagan's retainer? It says that, right?
Correct.
So we're supposed to interpret that to mean that actually Mr. Reagan and his wife didn't think that they were retaining an attorney?
We don't know if the Marcantonios had other cases pending. Mr. Reagan is a bankruptcy attorney, and they did end up filing a bankruptcy.
It's just Judge Cardoza wasn't making the argument you're making, I believe. He said, additionally, and unfortunately, even if the court accepts the statements concerning the previous counsel's representation, the law still dictates the same result. So
right.
You're raising a separate argument of what he relied on, and he was actually relying on what Justice McKenna was asking Mr. Dubin about, which is the BDM Sage Code requirement of a meritorious defense. Do you want to address that, or is that an argument you don't think is well-based?
Well, I think that that's equally relevant, too. But, again, there's just simply no evidence that...
No evidence? You're making statements. No evidence. There isn't any evidence. This isn't like who has the preponderance. I mean, the argument of no evidence is a very, very strong statement.
He says in his declaration, we did not hear from him for a while and assumed he was working on our case.
Right. What case?
Right. And then they say that we contacted him and he was told there was nothing he could do since the judgment was granted.
Right. But there's no reference to this case.
You know what? I think you should move on. Seriously.
Okay.
Why don't you address the other possible arguments that might support the report?
So... When Mr. Dubin and I argued Merz v. Wise 6 years ago, as part of that, the briefing, this court asked us to brief two other issues. And those issues are relevant today as well. One of those issues was ratification, and the other one was the evidentiary admissibility of the endorsed promissory note. And in that brief on the admissibility of the endorsed promissory note, we cited the court to both Hawaii Rule of Evidence 902B as well as Hawaii Revised Statute 490:3-308A. And what Rule of Evidence 902B says is that promissory notes are negotiable instruments, and they're admissible. They're deemed presumptively valid unless objected to. And that's what the statute says, that if it's submitted and unless it's expressly denied that it's invalid, it's deemed admitted. It needs to be accepted by the court. So there was no answer filed. And again, as the record reflects, the Marcantonios didn't even contact, allegedly, Mr. Reagan until after their answer was due. So they never filed an answer. And in fact, throughout this case, they never filed an answer. They never denied the validity of the note. They haven't paid on this loan in over a decade.
They couldn't file an answer because default had been entered. And the motion to set aside entry with default was denied. So therefore, you don't get to file an answer if you're in default. You can only contest the amount of damages, not liability.
Well, I would agree with Your Honor, except that you can file whatever you want, whether or not the court deems it relevant or addresses it is another issue. Mr. Dubin filed multiple pleadings in this case. But again, if we go back to the issue of when they knew, they admit that they knew sometime after the interlocutory decree foreclosure judgment had been entered. But again, they went ahead and they filed a bankruptcy. They delayed this case for years before contacting Mr. Dubin. So they knew at that point that...
Years?
Years. Yeah. So... They knew at that point that they had not done anything in that case. Even if we accept that they believed that they had retained Mr. Reagan, and then they found out later that he hadn't done anything. They knew for years. They knew during their bankruptcy. And as we discuss in our answering brief, their bankruptcy schedules, Mr. Marcantonio's bankruptcy schedules.
When you say years, the findings of fact and the foreclosure decree was entered in March of 15, correct?
Correct.
All right. And then they, Mr. Dubin entered his appearance in March of 16, and then April of 16, he filed a motion to set aside. So from the time that they conclusively knew that summary judgment had been entered, it was 13 months, correct? And is that in your view? First of all, is that correct? And secondly, is that too long?
That's correct, but then they continued to, this case went on for years after that even, with no appeal being filed, with no answer being filed, with no motion. The motion wasn't even filed to set aside the findings of fact until after the confirmation hearing.
I thought it was April 8th of 2016. There was a motion to set aside entry of default and foreclosure decree. That was then denied in July, correct?
That's correct.
So there was a 13-month delay from when the findings were entered in March of 15 until the motion was filed in April of 60. Is that compliant with Rule 60? And Mr. Dubin's answer is, well, there were bankruptcy petitions, and that's a reason for excusing the delay. What's your response?
We can look at the bankruptcy filings, though, and see what they show, and that is addressed in our answering brief. But again, there's...
I'm sorry, is there a statute that says that the filing of bankruptcy under the federal system stays deadlines or tolls deadlines in state court proceedings? I'm asking. I don't know the law along those lines.
The 362 can stay certain deadlines, but it only prevents actions against the debtor. So the debtors can continue to do whatever they want.
Okay.
There would be nothing precluding Mr. Marcantonio or any of the, again, the other applicants hadn't filed bankruptcy, but there'd be nothing precluding them from filing a motion to dismiss and or for reconsideration while their bankruptcy case was pending.
Dismiss or set aside?
Either. If they...
Why would they file a motion to dismiss? Would they be a motion to set aside the default?
Well, if
they actually did. So my question to you is, could they have filed that motion sooner? Mr. Dubin said they can't do it because there's a bankruptcy. Could they have filed the motion that they eventually did file on April 16? Could they have done that sooner?
Yes, they could have.
Despite the bankruptcy.
The bankruptcy stay, again, only stays action against a debtor. It doesn't stay anything by the debtor. So the debtor can continue to file motions. Okay. I don't know if the court had any other questions or if I've addressed...
mootness issue? Any further? Is there a transfer certificate of title that's been entered in the subsequent to the sale to the third party?
There has been a new certificate of title issued. The number has been issued. It hasn't been certified. And it won't be certified for another 5 or 6 years. And that's just the reality of the land court right now. And I think under the court's rulings in OMIA, the court has addressed this issue. I don't want to discuss it unless the court has any questions. But as far as mootness, again, there has to be bright lines throughout this case. And if there's not, the system just simply doesn't work. In this case, again, it's been 10 years since these borrowers paid anything on this loan. They waited, for whatever reason, they waited for well over a year while they received notices. And again, it wasn't just notices from the plaintiff in the underlying case. It was notices from the other parties. It was notices of the entry of judgment. And then even after that, as Justice Rechtenwald noted, 13 months again before they went and filed anything to seek to set aside that judgment. At some point during these cases, there has to be a bright line. Mers v. Wise established that bright line, and hopefully this court will reaffirm that. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Rosen. How much time does this committee have remaining?
3 minutes and 39 seconds.
Very briefly, a bankruptcy issue. When someone files a Chapter 13 in bankruptcy, they don't have to care about findings of fact, default, because if they're able to make the scheduled payments, then the summary judgment goes away. So therefore, it's not correct to say that you can't do anything if you file bankruptcy.
What's Mr. Rosen's argument is that the motion that was filed in April of 16 by herself to set aside entry of default and foreclosure decree could have been filed sooner than the bankruptcy petition. There was no impediment to that. What's your response to that?
It could have, but there was no reason to do it because when you file a Chapter 13, it suspends everything. And if you're successful with the Chapter 13, the summary judgment goes away, the default goes away.
There's no argument here that anyone's in violation of a bankruptcy stay, right?
No.
These bankruptcies were dismissed, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I want to address a couple of issues. The idea that the court rules reverses in this case, no one will buy. It's acknowledged that the properties sell for 50 to 75% of value, and they're sold without title insurance. So somebody knows they're taking the risk when they buy a foreclosed property. They have to buy it even without title insurance. Now, for example, recently in the Barnechea case, in my case with Judge Cardoza, I got that reversed after the property had been sold twice to two other families. He reversed it because there was not personal jurisdiction. That's an easy one for reversal. And it didn't matter whether the property had been sold twice after that.
Rule 60 is pretty clear, right? If there is a proper Rule 60B motion, it can be filed with respect to a final judgment. An unappealed judgment is a final judgment. So that I don't think that's at issue here. The issue really is whether or not, in this case, you had something. In this case, whether there was some basis for you to set aside the judgment. That's what we're addressing here.
Well, we had supervening authority. We had defective hearsay declarations.
I looked at your motion to set aside, your Rule 55 and Rule 60B motion. You argued based on standing and abandonment.
All right. If you go to page 4 of the ICA decision in this case, they point out that standing, quoting them, actually they're quoting a Supreme Court case, they're quoting the Weiss case. They say, page 4, we conclude the res judicata would preclude, despite the general proposition that a lack of standing may be raised at any time. Under the doctrine of res judicata, challenges of respondent's standing were subsumed under the foreclosure judgment, which had become final. So only in foreclosure cases does res judicata trump standing issues.
Does Rule 60B allows motions to set aside judgments to be filed for various reasons? I don't see standing mentioned in there. I guess it could be something that is, under Rule 60B6, any other reason. However, I don't think this Wise case pertains only to foreclosure judgments. It appears that what you are arguing is that years down after a final judgment, a defendant should be able to come in and arguing this plaintiff never had standing and therefore this judgment needs to be set aside.
A stranger can't foreclose on you.
I understand. That is a void judgment. Rule 60B is very clear. If a judgment is void or if there's fraud, if this was a true stranger that you know, didn't even have a mortgage or a note, and they came in and pretended like they did? That's fraud. That's a void judgment.
If it turns on jurisdiction, may I present the court after this hearing with the language, and I think it was the Brent case where this court said it's jurisdictional?
Yes, we're aware of that. So please take a look at the Tax Foundation case, the recent case in which we clearly held that standing is not jurisdictional. We clarified the confusion in the law.
I will, but what does that mean? That means that somebody can come in and foreclose on you that doesn't own your debt, and that's not jurisdictional?
That's a separate case. That's not this case.
Well, that's what
we could address that if that was the case.
Well, we argued that there was no evidence that they had that. They didn't...
You argued it, but the note was attached to the complaint.
But it's also contractual. They have to show that they are the lender, that they have the right.
Mr. Dubin, anything further at this point to summarize the report briefly?
On the issue of mootness, I'll just reference the opposition to the motion to dismiss, where I pointed out that my clients still have problems with their credit. They still have issues, which I pointed out in the paper. That for them, it's not yet moot. And also, there's that issue of damages. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both of our attorneys today. The court will take this matter under advisement.